welcome to the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. Today's guest is June Kim, art director for Epicurious.com, and we're going to be talking about a redesign at Epicurious focused on search and shop. Hi, how are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
Very, very good. You're in the One World Trade Center?
Yes, we are.
How high up are you?
Right now we're on the 24th floor. Epicurious is typically on 33rd.
Okay, so you're down in a recording booth on the 24th floor.
Yes, that's right.
What's the view from the 33rd floor like?
It's pretty great. You can really see sort of a panorama of the city. You know, you've got kind of huge walls of windows, a lot of sunlight coming in. So it has a really great view for sure.
And how long have you been there?
We moved in January of last year, so I would say about a year and a half at this point.
It's getting nicer around there.
There
was so much destruction, and there's still so much construction and reconstruction that I at times when you go down there, just like go down to Church Street or something, it can feel overwhelming, all the construction and whatnot.
Right, absolutely. When we first moved in, honestly, there was just construction everywhere. It was actually even hard to navigate to get to the building.
Yes.
But slowly, little by little, everything's been popping up. Things are becoming more polished. We have this kind of underground passageway that goes from the subway to our office building, which is really beautiful.
The new subway station?
I don't know if the subway station itself is new. It's just sort of the pathway between. You can kind of walk in between underground. And if you've been down here, you've seen these huge white arches that they have going on. I think for a while they were sort of behind these fences. You didn't really know what they were for.
Right.
But now you can actually walk underground where those arches are. And it's really a beautiful experience. There's still a lot of sunlight coming in. It's very white, but very beautiful.
Kind of like an Apple store.
Kind of like an Apple store, yes.
Or like I was just looking at some architecture in Spain. It's like modern architecture in Spain that looks kind of like a skeleton or a curved exoskeleton. I don't remember the name of the architect,
right.
But yeah.
Right. Yeah, actually when you're inside, it's almost like you're in the belly of a whale or something.
Mm.
But I believe the architect meant for it to look like a bird in flight, which I think when you're looking at it from the outside, it really looks like, you know, it's about to take off almost.
If you're just, I'm not sure, I always get disoriented downtown because the grid stops. I'm not sure whether you're looking south at it or looking west at it. I think you're looking west. But like if you're on Church Street looking at it,
I think it's east, maybe.
East, okay. East? Maybe, but it does look like that. It does
right.
look like that. It's fantastic. And I've right. also seen they have folks working on it almost every day on these large cranes washing.
Yes.
Because all that beautiful white skeleton, like those bird bones that
right.
need to be washed from city grit every
exactly.
day. So
yes.
it probably costs like, I don't know what, $500,000 a day to just maintain that thing.
the downfalls of living in the city.
But it must be inspiring going through that passage in the morning.
It is. You know, I don't actually walk through it every morning. I just walk through. We have another building where it actually houses a lot of our web design team. So I'm walking usually back and forth for meetings sometimes. And it's really nice to kind of just have that moment in the day, you know, to take a breath and look at something beautiful.
Yes. Yes. It totally helps you design.
For sure.
Yeah. I was at a screening of a video yesterday, the red carpet premiere of Design Disruptors,
uh-huh.
Documentary about...
Right.
And afterwards, there was some Q&A with a couple of really, really talented designers, and someone asked, well, what do you do for inspiration? And a lot of the times, it just is get out, walk around, look at something
Absolutely.
Different.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so funny. I was actually just talking about this with some of our coworkers this week in our weekly design meeting. it's so important to kind of get out there and get inspiration from other areas aside from design. I think sometimes you can really get tunnel vision and you think to yourself, okay, let me look for inspiration within the design world, right? Like you look at a beautiful piece of typography or some pattern or other websites for inspiration. And that's really great. But when you really look outside of the industry and outside of the field, I feel like you can just gain so much more richness in your work. I think it's kind of easy to forget that, to be honest, you know, like I need a reminder every once in a while, like, hey, look at the architecture around you, you know, look at what a person is wearing in fashion. All of that, I think, can inform graphic design.
Totally. And we're lucky to live in a city where there's so much fascinating architecture.
Right. Absolutely.
Architecture, I always think, is a good analogy to a website because the architect creates kind of the platform for an experience.
Yes.
And then the people imbue it with meaning by using it.
Right,
and
right.
Our job is to design for people.
Right.
And so let's talk about your job in this redesign. I think the best place for folks to look is if they go to epicurious.com/search. And then they can see this because it's a soft launch. You haven't made a big deal about it, but you've very much overhauled Epicurious to be about the search experience or search and shop, I guess.
Yes. And I will say, actually, so we soft launched about 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
But our hard launch was yesterday.
Oh.
So that was really exciting. We rolled out all the features. You know, we soft launched with kind of an MVP. It sort of had the foundation and the core of the experience. But we rolled out a lot of new exciting features yesterday.
Wait, in 2 weeks you went from soft launch to hard launch?
Yes.
And rolled out all the additional features in 2 weeks? How big is your team?
We have a team of 5 developers. We had 2 designers working on this project, and I was art directing.
Okay.
So a small, nimble team, but you know, we did a lot of planning. We have a really strong product manager who's kind of overseeing everything.
Right.
So we're small, but we're scrappy, and we get stuff done.
People think big publications, big companies are these massive monoliths, but very often there's little teams inside that can do what they do. I mean,
right.
Yeah. So
I think, you know, especially within the context of Condé Nast, you know, I like to think of us as like the scrappy team in One World Trade. It lets us kind of move quickly like this, like go from a soft launch to a hard launch in 2 weeks.
Now how did Epicurious start? Was it originally a print magazine for years?
No, actually, we always started as a website. We started in 1995, so actually, as of August, we'll be 21 years old.
Cool.
We were, I want to say, if not the first, at least one of the first kind of real recipe websites when we first came out. You know, we have actually a really interesting, for our 20th anniversary last year, we went around and spoke with a lot of the original staff. So there's actually a really interesting oral history that's on the site of Epicurious. And it's just so fun to hear all the stories of what it was like to work on the web those days. You know, they're like talking about how their servers are next to these plants by the window. And if the plant is in the wrong place, then like the whole website goes down and that kind of thing.
I started at the same time and I totally remember those times and that craziness.
Yeah,
the site would go down and someone would have to go kick basically a computer under their desk.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the cable came loose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But in that story, you know, the founder of Epicurious is talking sort of about how she came up with this idea. And she tells this anecdote about how on Thanksgiving, she was trying to cook these 2 turkeys. She had to cook for a bunch of people. And she had to have, I think, I'm probably getting part of the details wrong, but I think she had to cook like 1 turkey in the oven and 1 turkey outside in like the freezing degree weather. And she was kind of thinking to herself, how do I do this? What can I do? How do I cook this turkey in the middle of winter? And she went on the internet and basically put her question out there and was amazed that she got all of these responses and advice kind of right away. And she thought to herself, wow, there's like such a huge community out there around food. This is a great idea for a website. We should make this into something.
That's fantastic. And I can actually relate to that. I have a website called A List Apart. It's a magazine for web designers, and we started also as a mailing list. Mm-hmm. And basically, in response to other mailing lists, there were mailing lists, and it's like, these mailing lists are good, but they have problems X, Y, and Z, so I'll solve that by making it a different kind of mailing list. And then, wow, there's so many folks, we can probably do a website. And it was, and back then, the barrier just, I mean, you don't launch a Condé Nast publication from nothing, but you can launch a website, and you certainly could launch a website back then very easily with almost no expense.
Right.
But let's talk about the current website and what you've been working on. What were the problems that you were trying to solve? Why did you decide to go to a search as opposed to browse-based experience? What was going on there?
So we wanted to revamp our search really because we wanted to overhaul it in a way that addressed the way that our users wanted to use it and the way that are really to address our users' needs. Our old search was kind of very, it was a little bit antiquated. You know, it sort of got the job done. You could search for something, you could enter a term, but it was a little bit slow. You know, every time you applied a filter, it would reload the entire page. Design-wise, it was not a lot of visual hierarchy established. So you had a lot of information on the page. All of it was kind of the same weight. It was difficult to scan. You know, so again, it definitely did the job. You know, it was great in that way. You know, it functioned. But we really wanted to overhaul search in a way that spoke to our users' needs. When you look at Epicurious, we have a huge database of recipes. Search is arguably the most important function on our site. And so we wanted to really address that and give it the attention that it deserved. Now, when we redesigned, we had a huge redesign and relaunch last year in 2015. And we couldn't actually redo search at that time because in that moment, we switched to a different content management system. So for a while, we were in this kind of dual world where our recipes lived in one system and our articles lived in another.
Yeah, that's all awful.
Right. So it was very difficult. And so we couldn't actually revamp search right at that moment. But as we, over the last year, spent a huge amount of effort migrating our recipes and, you know, props to our tech team, it was just a huge, huge effort.
There's probably a lot of archival stuff that's even formatted differently, I would imagine.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So once we kind of migrated all to the same system, now we were like, okay, let's turn attention to search. It's kind of, again, one of the most important things that users do on our site. And so when we were looking to redo this, we were really looking at kind of two main objectives. One was to approach it from a sense of utility. We like to think of ourselves as a utility site, right? Like, what kind of utility can we offer to the home cook? This is what distinguishes us from, you know, we're not looking at food through travel. We're not looking at food necessarily. You know, we do these things, but through the lens of utility, right? So we wanted to, what we were considering when we were kind of kicking off this project is, what tools can we offer to people that will make the searching experience really useful and really help them find what they need? The other part of this was inspiration. You know, we kind of have come and written, we have this amazing editorial team that now writes a lot of content, a lot of expert advice around cooking. And so we wanted to make sure that our users knew that this content existed and were able to find it really easily. So there's sort of this discovery aspect of it too.
Right. So it's kind of a hybrid between search and browse still.
Exactly.
And you have these beautiful drop-down filters.
Right.
In the new so that I can type vegetarian, for example, I can type vegetarian, which is like typical search.
Right.
Or instead I could type some food, I don't know, I could type asparagus, and then dietary concerns, vegetarian, kid friendly, low fat, whatever.
Right.
But it is kind of, it doesn't look like Netflix, don't get me wrong, but it's that kind of abundant experience of, wow, there are so many choices here. They're right. all they're all targeted. They're all, you know, they're all relevant, but.
And I will say, yeah. It's, you know, so you mentioned Netflix. I will say what was really important for us to do actually in the initial research phase was to go outside of the food space and yes. look to lots of different areas for inspiration, right? So we did take a look at Netflix. We also looked at shopping sites. You know, we looked at like Nike. We looked at photography sites. How does Getty aggregate their images, right? So there were lots of different ways that we kind of approached this project so that we weren't just kind of tunnel visioning ourselves into the food space. So we really took a look at a sweep of different industries and how they handle search, how their users are interacting with search. Some of the things that we came up with, for example, and these are things that rolled out yesterday with our kind of hard launch, is we have a quick view function, right? So you can view right in line a little preview of the recipe without actually leaving the search results page.
Like at a clothing site.
Exactly. So that's kind of a cue from shopping. And if you think about recipes, as we were doing this, it's kind of like when you are looking through recipes, it's a little bit different than, say, if you're doing a search on New York Times, right? Like if I'm doing a topic if I'm searching for a topic on New York Times, I'm not necessarily thinking, okay, this article is going to be better than this article. You know, I need to kind of like select between these two. Whereas recipes, you're searching for roast chicken, you want to really be able to look at a bunch of different things very quickly before you're selecting the exact recipe for you. Sort of in this same vein, we also have a compare tool. It allows you to select up to three recipes and put them into a little bit of like a compare bucket.
How does that work? I'm on a page.
So if you hover over a recipe, you should be able to, if you're not seeing it, it might be a little bit of a bug. We did launch yesterday.
No. But when I hover, I get, so I'm on a desktop browser, I should
yes.
say, right?
Exactly.
On a desktop browser, I'm hovering and I get title text, a clean, refreshing, basically the same title that's used under the menu is showing up.
Right, exactly.
How are you exposing the...
So what you should see there is a hover state that kind of you have a little bit of an opacity layer over the search result, and you'll see the option for both quick view and add to compare.
I'm not seeing that yet.
And make sure what you need to do is make sure that this is a function specifically for recipes.
Okay, recipes. Good. So
right. So find if you go and filter, I would say
I'll type eggplant.
Type eggplant, and then if you go, this is an easy way for you to just do it. If you go to the top right, just do show recipes. There's a little content filter.
Yeah, I'm not seeing that either. This is remarkable. I wonder if this is cached, and I'm looking at something old. Huh. I see Epicurious. This, I love doing live demos, don't you? I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. Okay.
If you type eggplant, maybe just do it this way. Search for, as you can see on the search results cards, they're marked by.
Oh, should I just click the word red recipe? Oh no, reviews.
So if you hover over.
Oh, now I'm seeing it.
Right. So
that's remarkable.
So you see quick view and you see add to compare. What you can do is add up to three recipes to your compare bucket.
Oh my gosh. Oh, this is fun.
Right. And as you do this, when you click the compare button, you can actually see all three recipes on the same screen, side by side, all the ingredients, the prep steps. So you can really do an exact comparison right on the same screen to help you select the recipe that's right for you. So if you're thinking, actually, I'm looking for something with just two ingredients, or I'm looking for something with like very short prep steps, this is a super easy way for you to kind of compare recipes and see that in a snapshot immediately.
This is fantastic. So yeah. How did you come to think of that? What What was your research like, and what led you to want to do this? Was this something you heard from users? Is it something you observed in leaving out, stepping aside from websites and looking how cooks actually organize their cards, or what?
Yeah, it was a combination of both. So we did do a big push for user research around this project. We sent out a survey to our users and asked them sort of how they cook in the kitchen, how they use recipe tools, how they use search tools. And beyond that, like I mentioned before, this is something actually that we've seen on some shopping sites too, right? So if you're looking for a shoe and you're like, I want to look at this black shoe, this black sneaker compared to this other black sneaker that might have this little different type of shoelace, right? You can see those things side by side. And we thought that's a great analogy to how people use search for recipes, you know, how useful that would be for recipes.
You have to tell me where to shop for shoes then, because the sites that I use don't do that. I basically go, what was the thing on the other thing? I basically have to have like 5 different apps open and 17
right,
windows.
Right, you got to open like you got to open like multiple tabs, and then you're switching back and forth between tabs, and it's kind of a very clunky experience.
Right, and then you order, but you're ordering from an earlier part of your journey, so the shopping cart doesn't know you were there, and this solves all that.
Right.
This episode of the Big Web Show is brought to you by Braintree Payments. By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it will be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay, or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. Accept everything and anything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes out, all you have to do to update is just change a few lines of code. Simple, secure payments, code you can integrate quickly. If you don't have time, give them a call and they'll even handle the integration for you and walk you through it. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. That's braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. It is a great service, and they do help us put this show on, so please do check them out. Thank you very much. And we are back with June Kim, art director who supervised the Epicurious redesign, which hard launched yesterday. And we were just talking about a compare feature in the search engine and beginning to talk about research that led to this redesign. How much generally in your work, how much research would you say that you do, you personally and your team, and how many features come, because it's editorial now, it's a publication, how many requests come from an editorial board or from an editor with an idea or a designer with an idea?
So for me, something that was really important to me to establish as a part of our process every time was to have this research phase. I think oftentimes what's a little bit of a struggle is that, you know, you've got these timelines and these roadmaps, which are all important to keep. And there can be a little bit of a tension of kind of going full speed ahead and kind of trying to launch as quickly as possible versus being able to spend the time that you need to really make a good product, design it the right way, conduct the user research. So there is a balance there. You know, I always feel like we could have a little bit more time on the research phase, but it is something that's super important, I think, for every project. In this particular one, myself and the two designers that were working with me, we really kind of dove deep into research for about 2 weeks. It was just kind of heads down, let's put all of our other projects aside. We know that this project's coming up. Let's just do a deep dive into every search experience you can think of. Right? Like no limitations, no kind of let's only look at food, like I mentioned. It's really just take a huge net of what's out there and let's really start to call that together. Look at what works, what doesn't work, what are some great ideas that are out there? You know, the compare feature, again, is something we saw on shopping sites. QuickView is a really useful thing that a lot of people use that we wanted to kind of incorporate into our site. I feel like that was a really important part of our process and kind of led to a lot of inspiring moments that you can now see on the redesign today.
What was the process like? Did you sit together in a room looking at things and discussing them? Did you use whiteboards? Did you each go off for like hours at a time doing private research and then come back and compare results?
Yeah, it was pretty much, it was really the latter. So we spent a little bit of time individually, just kind of, again, doing a deep dive into what's out there, and then came together, presented results to each other, presented our findings to each other, talked through sort of what things were working well, what things weren't working well. And then also spent some time going through that. So it sort of started as on a smaller level with just the design team, and then it kind of got broader and broader and broader, right? As we brought in the editorial team, brought in our tech team and product teams.
Did they do the same research, or did you present findings to them and get their feedback?
So we started by presenting findings, but then we also kind of put that question out there to them, right? Like, what are some sites that you see that where search is working really well for you? What are some tools that you see where search is working really well for you? And then conversely, you know, I like to look at the flip side of that too. Like, what are some things that you see that don't work really well, right? Like, what are things that, you know, are just too flashy or gimmicky that, you know, you see on sites that we don't want to do on our search? Again, it was a very, it sort of is something that starts as a seed in the design team in terms of like the research process for this particular project. But it really just kind of grows into our whole team. You know, something that I was talking about earlier is how we're a little bit scrappy. And I think what's really great about being a lean team is that you can have these projects that really feel collaborative across the entire team, right? And so it is a big team effort. It's something that's nice because it just feels like you all worked on it together, you're launching it together. It's something that we're all super excited about. It's not something that, you know, we're just kind of working on behind closed doors and then suddenly it launches and people don't know. You know, it really is sort of something that all of Epicurious is behind.
Yeah. Now, how do you focus a conversation like that? I agree, it's really important to get everybody's input, but it's also difficult in meetings to keep meetings from getting derailed by personalities or one person's agenda.
Absolutely.
I'm not saying anybody had one. I'm just saying humans are humans.
Of course.
So how did you provide freedom but also provide constraints for the conversation?
Well, I think from a design perspective, you know, and as an art director, I always like to come to the table with my findings and having a presentation, but also making a pretty clear recommendation, right? And I find that that helps focus the conversation instead of just saying, okay, here's like the 30 sites we looked at and the 100 features that we saw, you know, go for it. Just, you know, Everyone just like talk at random. We can kind of present the things that we saw and then say, okay, here's like the 5 key things that we really recommend should go into this experience. And I find that that really helps focus conversation. That, of course, doesn't necessarily mean everyone's always going to agree on those 5 key things, but it's a starting point, right? Like, it's a starting point for you to kind of discuss what's best and what's not best. And I think that that's been really successful for us.
The way you're talking sounds like a good team-driven experience, which is really nice. In my experience with publications, there can be a tendency for editorial folks to, I love editors, don't get me wrong what I'm going to say, but the tradition, right, the past of media is that the editors were all powerful, they were in charge. I've had editors, when I was a writer, defend me against a very important sponsor, like sponsors leaving the paper, we should fire this guy. Nope, we're not going to fire him. Nope. Church and state, all this stuff. Editors in the past were extremely powerful, and it wasn't a user-focused experience or a user research-focused experience. It was definitely a... So you're at Condé Nast, which is not like Joe's magazines. You know, how powerful is the editorial voice in this, and how do you navigate, here's what our agile, nimble team has come up with versus maybe a powerful editor's comment?
So for me, the way that I like to look at it is, and the method that I think is successful for us is that I think it's super important to get everyone in the room early, right? So rather than, you know, tech, product, and design going off into a corner, coming up with an idea, strategizing around these things, and then going to editorial with like a big formal presentation and saying, voila, you know, here's what we've come up with. Do you approve? Do you not approve? Right. Is to actually bring editorial into that conversation from the very beginning, right? When it's just the slightest seed of an idea and someone's just going, hey, what about this? To have editorial from the very beginning be there, you know, even when it's really not a polished state, right? Even when you're just whiteboarding, even when you're just in a room kind of spitballing ideas back and forth, to have editorial there right from the beginning, I think makes a huge difference, because you've got, you know, kind of the buy-in from the beginning because they're part of that process. And again, I think that really helps us. You know, I keep talking about teamwork and collaboration, and I think that method just really helps us continue that collaborative effort as we're going through the entire project, rather than coming to a point where, again, you have sort of, you know, like kind of packaged it together in some way and then like expect an approval later. I think that's kind of a much harder way to go about things. And that's when you can really kind of butt heads in that way. So we try to avoid that as much as possible by sort of getting stakeholders in early. And you know, not even just to avoid, you know, back and forth or avoid this tension that you're talking about. It's really because I really value the opinion of our editorial team. Like, they are often thinking, you know, they are speaking to the users too, and they're often thinking of things that we're not thinking about, right? Like, they'll come and say, oh, what about this thing that you didn't think of? You know, to have that extra voice in the room is really beneficial ultimately to the design process and to the product process as well.
Do you have folks, the stereotypical image is the folks with headphones, who actually talk to customers on the phone when the customer has a problem, and do you get that stuff reported back to you too? Like, I can't find chicken recipes.
So we don't have people with headphones, but most of our customer service is done through sort of email communication. So we do have someone that goes through the inbox, and you know, we're looking at the issues that users are experiencing. So we have a pretty good idea of what people are going through, right? You know, if you have someone that is saying, if we consistently find someone saying they're having a problem with something, you know, that's something that we can definitely take a look at.
And did you see stuff like that in this process? Did someone say, here's a pile of complaints? Or were you told about problems people had experienced in the past?
Yeah,
I
think, you know, we had not revamped search in a while. So there was kind of this ongoing, I don't want to say, you know, it wasn't like there was like a file or a folder somewhere. But certainly as we were ramping up for this project, there was kind of thinking through what users had been telling us throughout the years about how search could improve, what they might want to see. So there was definitely some portion of that too.
This makes me feel worried about search on my own content site, because it could be a lot better. And that is how people look for things, right? People, the editorial model that some of us grew up with is that, and is still true in some magazines, is editors decide this is the fall fashion issue, and they curate, and you know, and people come to be told what it's going to be about, and that's the
right
experience they're desiring. But in cooking, in home cooking, it's, you know, we really don't want an editor deciding that it's, you know, granola month or whatever. That's of no interest. I want to know what to do with eggs.
Right. Well, I think for us too, I think it was important for us to kind of have both of those things, right? So we'll have granola month, and you can come to us and see everything that you need to know about granola. But then we also have this amazing search experience where if you're not interested in granola, you want chicken that month, then you can go to our search and have all, again, like this discovery moment where all of our editorial content is right next to the recipes, and there's galleries and there's videos. And so you have all of that. So you can almost create your own chicken month whenever you want to through our search.
Beautiful. And let's talk about let's talk about your homepage and how it exposes the refocus on search to the user, because changing the search engine in itself isn't enough if you want people to actually come use it. What did you do to...
On our homepage, if you go to the Epicurious homepage, we really focus you on search. Like, we could not focus you on search anymore.
Right.
It's the first thing that you see. It takes up a big portion of the top part of the page.
I imagine it would take up the whole laptop.
Yes, exactly. And we have these big, beautiful images that that our photo editor shoots, you know, just for this space. And this is an area that we have, as part of the new launch, we've shot new beautiful photos for this space. So you can see those right on our homepage. Something that, you know, we're sort of considering for the future is how can this space move a little bit? You know, can we have some video or cinemagraph action? So that's something that we are sort of, you know, noodling on right now.
The interface is animated a bit, and that definitely helps make it feel alive when you begin to scroll on a desktop. You have a persistent navigation, but it doesn't just hang there. It sort of comes to life, and there's a little bit of bounce and stretch. There's a little bit of movement in the way it does that, which is very nice. Before it settles in and locks itself to the top.
Right.
So I do think there's life there. And tell me about the photography. Do you work with the photographers at all, or what do you know about it? How is this? Because, I mean, let me focus that question a little because it's so open-ended. part of this is to get accurate representation of recipes so people know what they're preparing. And so in your new comparison feature, I can go,
yeah,
I've got two things with lima beans. What do they look like differently? But at the same time, you also, the photographer has to romance it, because food on a plate can look very unappealing.
Right.
So
just to, I have to give a huge shout out to our photo editor. And just so you know, we have one photographer.
Holy cow.
Talk about scrappy. We have one photographer. We do work with a slew of freelancers when we need to, but we have, you know, pretty much one photographer. And she is amazing. As you can see from the work on the site, she just has such an amazing eye. The photography is beautiful. And, you know, I wish I could sort of show you what the photography looked like pre-launch, you know, just due to, we weren't really photo focused, to be honest, before our launch last year, I should say. And so due to kind of limited resources and things like that, the site relied, especially on the editorial side, when they were kind of creating editorial content, a lot on some stock photography. You know, recipe photos, of course, were always very important and were shot when they were needed. But when you looked at the site before, the photos were very downplayed because we weren't kind of able to do the justice that we were able to do to the food. When we relaunched in 2015, that was a huge focus of ours. And, you know, our really talented photo editor just came in and just really kind of revamped all of our photography. Now we shoot a lot. Almost all the photography you see on the homepage will be original. All of our new recipes we shoot. It's just, it really adds kind of a richness and depth to the visuals.
It's fantastic. And there's variety and consistency at the same time, which is it's a very hard thing to achieve.
Right. And also with, you know, just to speak a little bit to that search area specifically, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about what type of photos should go in this area, right? I think a lot of times when you go to food sites, you'll see like a very composed dish there. For us, we really went the route of ingredients. Because again, we're about the home cook, right? We wanted you to see things in process. How can we bring beauty to ingredients and process that's not just about that like perfectly composed, beautiful dish, right? It's really about what you're doing at home, what you're doing in the kitchen.
So there's to bring that to this
photo area.
Exactly. So I'm looking at radicchio salad with pickled grapes and goat cheese. And there is a nicely put together bowl of food on the right. But on the left, there's this bowl of grapes in a syrup that I assume is part of the recipe, showing how it was made. So there's,
right.
yeah, it's that right. combination of finished product on your family's table and what you know, the guts of the tools.
Right. Exactly.
Very nice. How do you think that this new emphasis on photography, which I applaud, has something to do with the different way people are using the web and the internet in this era? Because I think when older websites, like when Epicurious started, it could be all about the content. We have this great recipe and this great writer who's explaining, and there's humor in it, and it's wonderful. And oh, yeah, here's a little stock photography.
Right.
But now, in the era of Instagram and Pinterest and the way we interact visually with content on our devices, right? That, you know, with the introduction of the phone, it stopped being here's a bunch of nav bars.
Right.
And it started being touch this photo if you want to see more about this content.
Right. Absolutely.
I think you're reflecting that.
Definitely. I think people are just, like you said, Instagram is an obvious kind of tool that people use with photography. I think that people just want to see big, beautiful images on the web, on their phones. And I think also, you know, going back to talking about a little bit how we like to have some of the process moments in our photography, it also is a very useful tool when you're cooking, right? So when I am cooking pancakes and I want to see exactly what golden brown means, it's much easier to actually see that in a photograph than to kind of just imagine it through words. We have a article on our site. It's about whipped brownies. It's a technique it's a technique to make brownies where you whip your eggs. And it's all about kind of like having a ribbon to your whipped eggs. And really, you know, you could read about that and I can describe it to you as much as I can, but the photo just really brings it together, right? Like I'm cooking at home and I'm like, okay, what does a ribboned egg really mean? I look at the photograph and I'm like, oh, instantly, that's what it looks like. So I think, yes, part of it is informed by just in general how people use the web and the tools of social media and that kind of thing. But I also think it is about helping people cook better with the photography.
Got it. And if I want to look at that, whipped egg brownies is not the correct search term. What's the correct search term to find the thing you just described?
Let me see.
Because I get brownies with chipotle cherry whipped cream. And lots of other brownie recipes.
So the article is called the article is called The Secret to Better Brownies, You Must Whip It.
Okay.
And let me just pull up that actual brownie recipe.
Yeah. The Secret to Better Brownies, You Must Whip It. Easy. Easy peasy.
Right. And the recipe is in that article.
Yep. The eggs are magic.
The eggs are definitely magic. I can tell you I've made the brownies, and the eggs are definitely magic.
I would weigh 500 pounds if I worked in this publication. I would have to try everything.
And I know. It's a huge perk. Let me tell you that the test kitchen will give us stuff all the time.
Yeah.
And I can't say that I'm disappointed. You know, when you're like in a design hole and you're tired and someone tells you, hey, there's pie in the lounge. You're like, great. I can work for another 5 hours.
That's great. That is really nice. Your journey to being art director at this publication started how? You came in right out of school or?
No, so it's funny. I have kind of an interesting path to design. My whole life, I was one track mind to writing and editing. I was an English major in college. I was all about books. Straight out of school and undergrad, I went right into editorial and book publishing. Stayed there for a few years and loved working with books, but just realized that it wasn't quite as creative as I wanted it to be. A lot of times when you are an editor, a huge part of your job obviously is the editing of the authors. But another part of your job that is kind of equally as important is sort of negotiating and making deals and getting contracts together. And that was just a part of the job that I wasn't honestly very good at. And sort of as I was coming to this realization, you know, another part of the editorial process is to work with the designers, right? So you're looking at book covers, you're looking at interiors. I'm sort of thinking to myself, you know, this is really interesting. Like, is this a job that I can have? So I kind of made my way slowly to design school, and that's kind of how I got into design. Right out of school, I was interning at Mashable, and then I came on to Epicurious when we were first starting the redesign that I mentioned, which relaunched in 2015. So as part of the redesign process prior to that, and then became art director shortly after we relaunched.
How, it's nice that they promote from within.
Yes.
How did that happen? What do you think it was in your attitude, behavior, achievements, whatever, that led people to go, you know what, we don't have to look outside for a senior person. We've actually got one. We've groomed one now.
You know, I think, honestly, I remember, because I went to design school sort of later in my career, I remember always being really nervous that I was going to be behind. But I think that all of these other experiences that I had as an editor, and, you know, I worked actually while I was going to design school in order to put myself through design school and have the money to go to design school. I actually worked in recruiting in the finance industry for a little while. That's an interesting story. But, you know, all of these experiences, I think, really helped kind of help me in terms of becoming an art director, in terms of guidance, in terms of being able to be product focused, in terms of being able to manage projects and be collaborative. You know, I think when you are talking about the art director job, it's sort of much more beyond the scope of just being a good designer. And so I feel like these experiences that I had prior to even going to design school really helped me become that.
I completely agree, A, selfishly, because my background is like yours. I did a lot of other different kinds of things, professional and unprofessional, that all helped me be a good designer today. They all helped me. And because I think it gets at one of the themes that's emerged for me in our conversation today, which is looking beyond what's expected of you in your design field. So when you did your research, you didn't just look at websites for food. You looked at websites for all kinds of other things to see what could be gleaned there. And I think it's important to go beyond where, you know, every one of us can get into a silo, especially working in-house on a particular product. You can go, right, well, I'm a such and such person. I'm the typography person in this house of publishing or whatever. And I think it's really important to always have a broader background. I think you've said that in several different ways, that it, yes, helps you find new ideas for your product. And I think it sounds like it makes you better able to negotiate how you do design in your company and so on. I mean, what you've described isn't exactly the traditional waterfall that publishing houses do, and it isn't,
right,
the new traditional agile that startups do, where let's throw it out there, see how people react, and iterate, and iterate, and iterate, and iterate. It's somewhere in between those two things, and I think all the background of experiences you've had make you comfortable in that space and able to make others comfortable too. I think part of our job is to make others comfortable doing the work with us.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that can be really tough.
Right.
Not every designer is good at that. I've worked with some really talented people who weren't happy letting go of any control.
Right, right. And it's true. I feel like as a designer, though, you know, especially when you are working in a digital environment, you need to be able to work with so many different people and so many different personalities. You're not designing by yourself, right? You know, I love to sit alongside our tech team and tweak things. You know, I don't want to be working by myself on this perfect little design file and then pass it over and then never see it, right? Like, I love working closely with our tech team and our product teams. And like I said, with editorial, I think it's a really important part about being a web designer is being able to work with all these different personalities and teams.
totally agree. I hope listeners have taken something from this today. I know I have. I want to thank you for your time today. The site is Epicurious. It's E-P-I-C-U-R-I-U-S.
I-O-U-S.
I-O-U-S. I'm sorry. I just misspelled it because everyone knows how to spell epicurious.com. I don't know why I did that, but I just made it worse. But besides epicurious.com/search, which is the best, or just epicurious.com, and then you'll see search. You really won't miss it. Where can people find out more about you? Are you on Twitter, Facebook? Do you blog? Is there any place?
I'm big on Instagram, actually. Instagram. So you can find me on June Kim Design. And JuneKimDesign.com is also my own personal website as well.
Very good. June, thank you. Have a wonderful day today, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.